Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight, Gillum Ferguson, worked for many years as an assistant federal attorney in the Northern District of Illinois and retired just a few years ago to follow his literary pursuits or his historical pursuit, and he's done a wonderful new book, which I've been reading for the last few days. It is titled, quite directly, Illinois in the War of 1812. There's no such book until yours, I gather.
No, there had never been anything written that showed, told the whole story comprehensively, the history of Illinois in the War of 1812. There was a long article written in 1904 that was ripe for revision, and I, in working on another article, discovered that there really had been nothing written, and I decided, well, I'll write this book myself.
I'm sure that of the many things that Americans don't know about the War of 1812, one is the cardinal fact that we declared war against Britain.
Goaded into it. Even the pacifist administration of James Madison had really been pushed beyond its endurance. Mm-hmm. And I think that was perhaps the main importance of the war. It really served notice on the world that there were some insults the United States wouldn't swallow.
What insults were they?
Well, they were really twofold. On land, that we had encroachments on what's now the Midwest by British soldiers up until the 1790s, and then by British traders up till the very beginning of the war.
They were coming down from Canada.
From Canada, then a British territory, and they were monopolizing the fur trade with the Indians and also winning the Indians' loyalty towards their great father, the king, King George III, mm-hmm. our own former king. On the sea, in the battle with Napoleonic France, Britain was treating the United States just as if it were still a colony, boarding U.S. ships, seizing them if they had cargo bound for the continent.
And seizing American sailors and impressing them into the British Navy.
Oh, yes, indeed. If a sailor had been born in England, he was considered to be still a British subject. They didn't recognize American naturalization. And cargoes were seized as well. Between 1807 and 1812, over 900 U.S. ships were seized by the British.
So James Madison said, enough already, let's fight these bastards.
Well, he did, but he didn't take many precautions beforehand. He had just allowed the charter of the National Bank to expire on basically ideological grounds. It's the only institution in the country which could have financed a war. He'd done nothing to increase the size of the army.
Now, with regard to the War of 1812, what Americans know, if they know anything, they know of the burning of Washington and of the White House, Dolly Madison saving some of the material from within the White House. They know, surely, of the great battle that in which the British were profoundly defeated by Andrew Jackson, General Andrew Jackson, even though that Battle of New Orleans was waged after the peace was already signed in the Treaty of Ghent, isn't it?
It was. The Treaty of Ghent was signed on Christmas Eve, 1814, and the battle was fought on January the 6th. But actually, the common misconception that it was after the peace had been established was incorrect, because peace wasn't established until mutual ratifications of the treaty were exchanged in February.
So then officially they were still in a state of war, were they?
Still in a state of war.
That's an interesting clarification. But what then is the role of Illinois? We never really hear, and we until now that you've done this book, we will hear and read and learn about Illinois in the War of 1812.
Well, it's fair to say that the War of 1812 was more important to Illinois than Illinois was to the War of 1812.
Really?
The War of 1812 was part of the Napoleonic Wars, which consumed the world for 20 years, and it was really a frontier backwater in a sense. But in terms of the effect of the War of 1812 on Illinois, it was a pivotal event in bringing Illinois from territory status into statehood.
Well, you start the book with a chapter on Illinois at the dawn of the war, and it was a rather thinly populated place to begin with.
Well, indeed it was. The American settlers, white and black Americans, mm-hmm. were really clustered along the lower Mississippi River, south of St. Louis, and to some extent along the Wabash and Ohio Rivers, but there was very little American settlement that extended more than 20 miles from those rivers. Most of the territory, I should say, was empty. And the territory at that time included what's now Wisconsin and parts mm-hmm. of Michigan.
Was it called the Illinois Territory?
It was, after 1809, when it was split off from Indiana Territory.
How many Indians in the same territory?
Impossible to say exactly, but based on the estimates of number of warriors and extrapolating, probably somewhere between 15 to maybe 20,000 in what's now Illinois and Wisconsin. Very difficult to say. Obviously, they weren't included in the census of 1810, which numbered the Americans at 12,282.
Well, now, what's the military action What's the first military action of the War of 1812 that that is played through within Illinois itself? Who shoots at whom, or who raises tomahawks against whom?
Well, like in many things, it's a matter of definition. But I date the start of the war from June of 1811, when Indian warriors attacked a cabin in what's now Bond County, Illinois. That's south central Illinois. Mm-hmm. Overpowered a young man, cut his heart out, and then kidnapped his sister very brutally. And a party of militia went in pursuit of them. That was, in a sense, the beginning of hostilities. From that point, the frontier was more or less on a war footing, but actual warfare didn't begin until
June. So in Illinois, the war was essentially a war of the Indians against the white population and the white response.
It was in large part. There were, in fact, some penetration by British soldiers in 1814 in what's now the Quad Cities area. Future President Zachary Taylor battled red-coated British soldiers and their Indian allies in what's called the Battle of Credit Island. But primarily, our main antagonists were the Indian tribes.
But there is an act of great atrocity which occurs in the early stages in 1812 here in Illinois, here in Chicago, in fact, here about a few hundred yards from where we are sitting right now.
Undoubtedly the most dramatic incident of the war in Illinois.
The massacre at Fort Dearborn. And we will talk about that directly. We return after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
As I was saying just a moment ago, talking with Gillum Ferguson, author of Illinois and the War of 1812, the Fort Dearborn and the great massacres that occurred there, all of that is just a hop away from where we're sitting right now. We're in the Tribune Tower at the first floor level, just next to the river. On the other side of the river was Fort Dearborn.
Yeah, the location of the fort is marked, or the approximate location of the fort is marked by plaques in the pavement at Wacker in Michigan.
Yeah.
And it was actually, I understand, about 50 feet further north, but part of the location of the fort is now in the river, which has changed its course.
Even closer to us than is
even
indicated
closer.
By the blacks.
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, originally that was settled by Jean-Pierre Pointe-du-Sable, who was supposed to have been the first, quote, European to have settled in this area.
That's correct.
Though he wasn't a European. He was a Canadian, a partially black, partially French-Canadian, and who knows what else. But he did settle there. And later on, they built a fort where he had his temporary trading post. Is that right?
Very close to the spot, yep. Yes.
So in 1812, what's going on at the fort?
Well, there was a small garrison of 54 or so men commanded by Captain Heald, and it was a very, very isolated location. There was the nearest fort was at Fort Wayne, where there were about 70 men, and the only other military encampment in Illinois was
at Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Fort Wayne, what's now Fort Wayne, yeah. Indiana. It was at Fort Massac, 365 miles away on the Ohio River, where there were 36 men under a lieutenant. It was extremely isolated. Governor Edwards, who was governor of the Illinois Territory, wasn't even sure it was in his territory. It was just so remote. It was not a happy post, however, and probably because it was isolated. And when you ask what was going on in 1812, there was extraordinary dissension among the officers and other significant people around the fort, which led actually to bloodshed and violence, and the results of which, I think, colored many of the accounts of the massacre afterwards.
Well, there were surrounding Indian tribes. The Potawatomi were the main Indian presence, but what other tribes were represented?
Potawatomi were, this was really Potawatomi territory in Chicago, going as far up the lake as Milwaukee or Green Bay, and then down to the Illinois River, also Potawatomi territory. There were also a significant tribe in east central Illinois, the Kickapoo, and then in western Illinois, especially along the Fox River and what's now the Quad Cities area, the Sauk. And further up the Rock River, the Winnebago, who in fact did play a role in the early history of Chicago and really shed the first blood.
What's the story of the massacre? Why and how did it happen?
When war was declared, Fort Dearborn was seen as being undefensible. It was a strongly built fort. It was so far from any assistance or any supplies that it was determined to evacuate. Captain Heald, in command at the fort, received an order from General Hull, commanding at Detroit, who was Heald's superior officer, ordering him to evacuate the fort and head for either Fort Wayne or for Detroit, probably for Detroit by way of Fort Wayne. The Heald waited around about 6 days while he gathered supplies together and prepared for the trip, prepared to bring in the few civilians who lived in the small community outside the fort, and then on August 15th, finally set out with his command, the civilians who lived near the fort, and a couple of wagons loaded with supplies, including a number of children, and headed south along what's now Michigan Avenue, but was then the lakeshore, hoping to get to Fort Wayne.
Who came at them?
About while Heald was delaying, a large number of Indians had gathered at the fort, hoping that they would receive presents distributed by the soldiers as they were leaving. In fact, Heald had orders to do that. Most of them, in fact, almost all of them were Potawatomi, though there were a few representatives from other tribes, and they came from as far as Milwaukee or Oxable Creek down by the present Morris, Illinois, and had gathered to the number of about 500. Heald was trying to negotiate and thought he had negotiated an arrangement where he would distribute the goods in the fort and they would provide him an escort on his way to Fort Wayne. It, of course, didn't work out that way. When the Indians discovered that Heald had destroyed, and consistently with his order, had destroyed all the liquor and the ammunition, excess ammunition in the fort, they were angered, and most Indian sources indicate that was why they attacked.
Well, were these Indians under British command or control at all, or was the attack upon Heald's party and the death of some 50 people in the massacre as they were trying to get out and get and move towards Fort Wayne, was that assault essentially just another major and dreadful episode in the Indian wars against the American settlers?
It was primarily an Indian operation. Interestingly enough, General Isaac Brock, who's a British commander, then maneuvering to take Detroit, which he ultimately did, had given orders that British soldiers be sent to Fort Dearborn to obtain its surrender. And he did this not so much for military advantage as a way to save the lives of the garrison from the Indians. But by the time that he entered that order, the fort had already been destroyed.
The toll was really quite considerable, about 50 people killed.
Yes, about 12 children, a couple women, and 26 soldiers, and actually all of the men except John Kinsey, very prominent early trader here in Chicago, were killed. All the men who were civilians.
There's a terrible scene where there are some 12 children in a wagon, and one particular Indian dashes in and exterminates all of them.
The Indian was a part Potawatomi, part French warrior named, according to the information I've been able to find, named Benac. He was a French speaker. And according to at least one Indian source, he earned the lasting contempt of his tribe for doing that. But, of course, 12 children met a terrible death that day. Some others came close. One young lady, one of the Indians had pulled from the wagon, and she was struggling. He tried to scalp her, but she was biting and struggling so hard that he was delayed, and an elderly Indian woman who had been a guest in her house periodically intervened and saved her life, though she was, in fact, scalped and bore the mark of that for the rest of her life.
All of this happens in 1812. What date is that exactly?
August 15th, 1812. So we have the 200th anniversary coming up very soon.
Yeah.
I've been told that the city is not planning anything to commemorate that event. I hope I've been told incorrectly.
Seems to me there should be something right there on the other side of the river on that particular day.
It has some national significance, not only in Illinois. For instance, one of the officers killed that day, Ensign George Ronan, for whom Ronan Park on the west side is named, was the first graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point to be killed in action about 2 miles from where we're sitting.
Now, that's a major incident in the Illinois portion of the War of 1812. What's the further involvement of Illinois in that war?
Well, after the destruction of Fort Dearborn, American influence in northern Illinois was at an end, and the British used Chicago periodically as a point to supply Indians, but they never did establish a permanent ongoing presence there. After that, the American control was really limited to southern Illinois, and the story of 1813 was slow expansion up the Illinois River to try to reclaim some of the territory lost. By 1813, the Illinois Rangers and federal troops built a fort at Peoria, but they were unable to really assert much control other than within the walls of the fort. In 1814, the United States tried to expand up the Mississippi River as far as the southwest part of Wisconsin, the Prairie du Chien. But that ended very badly when the American fort there was captured by a mixed force of British and Indians. And a relief column was turned back with loss.
One of the most astonishing things about the War of 1812, if you look into the historical record, and like most Americans, I know very little about the War of 1812. But what, to me, one of the most astonishing things is that it was a war in which the casualty level is really quite low.
It is, and I understand something like 40% of them were from Kentucky, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, the overall number of casualties in Illinois would probably, between Americans and Indians, would have been probably less than a couple hundred.
The total overall casualties, or the total overall combat deaths of American personnel in the War of 1812, according to something I just took off the computer, just took off the internet, was only 2,260 people in all the war. Another 4,500 wounded, total casualties of 6,765, which is 3% of the total enrolled force.
The major loss actually was to disease and illness at that time, which I think was, I've been told, is something like perhaps as much as twice the battle number of battle deaths. It was much probably your greatest risk as a soldier in that war was to be attacked by dysentery and die. But there were obviously a significant number of battle deaths, but nothing like what we saw in other wars.
Nothing crucial happened in Illinois then to turn the tide of the war. The war was won by us, but not in Illinois, apparently.
It was, yeah, who won the War of 1812 is of course, partly a matter of definition, is disputed by different historians. Certainly, the United States accomplished some of its objectives in terms of making an entry on the world stage. But in Illinois, though it didn't affect the overall course of the war particularly, it was crucial in terms of the development of Illinois and the opening of it for settlement. Because the Indians were not so much defeated as they were demoralized, and it really broke their spirit because it deprived them of the services of their ally, Britain, and it showed that, in fact, that they really were unable to stop the American tide.
And so what, did they begin to move out, or were they pushed out?
They were eased out, might be a better way to put
All
it,
right.
Through a series of treaties which were certainly not a bright spot in the diplomatic record of the United States. They were compensated. Before we get too righteous about this, it's important to remember that south of a line drawn between Springfield and Decatur, there were virtually no Indians in Illinois. And those who are in the north half of the state who are antagonists in the War of 1812 were really relatively recent settlers. None had been there established in the state for more than one or two generations, and they had, in fact, dispossessed the Illini Indians by force and violence, not by treaty. So they had won what they held by right of conquest, and fairly recently. That doesn't, however, entirely excuse the way that even friendly Indians were treated after the war.
Of course, they're still here, but we don't see them. The Potawatomi are still fairly numerous in the state of Wisconsin.
There are some in Wisconsin, some in Kansas, too, I understand. None in Illinois.
No.
And I think that's one of the interesting things I found as I looked into this. Illinois comprises over 55,000 square miles. And in that entire vast, fertile expanse, no room could be found for 10,000 to 15,000 Indians. Not exactly something to be proud of, but it's not, on the other hand, something that probably would have been avoided.
In my youth, when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin pursuing a master's degree, I got involved with a young lady who was in anthropology, just as I was in psychology. She went up north with some introductory letters to talk to the Potawatomi and to the yet another group to see which one would have her or would accept her to do some ethnographic work in the summer that was coming upon us. So I met some Potawatomi up there. They were working on the land. They seemed rather poor and not particularly organized in an effective community. It looked there was a lot of despair in the air. Whereas the Stockbridge Mohegans, who had been moved to Wisconsin, I think in the middle of the 19th century, kicked out of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and that area, maintained a very different and much more vital community. So she chose to be to study them rather than the Potawatomi, to which the tribal chief who was a bright young fellow, said, "That's wonderful. We've never had an anthropologist of our own before."
Well, my understanding is that the Potawatomi in Kansas have maintained more tribal integrity, if I could use that term, than those who were left behind. Those who were left behind really unofficially.
But the peace comes in 1814 or there, that Treaty of Ghent, and then it is fully confirmed, and the war is over. And then the movement west really brings many more people rather quickly to Illinois.
Illinois in 1810 had 12,282 people. Yeah. In 1818, it had 40,000, was confident enough to apply for admission to the Union. And after that, the population trebled every 10 years.
And Chicago starts growing, of course, as well.
Chicago, once it was reoccupied after 1816, was on its way. And by 1832, I think, was incorporated.
So we need to look at the post-war period for what its significance is in the general history of the United States and certainly in the development of this part of the world. We'll continue with that directly after an update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Gillum Ferguson, for many years a leading figure in the federal attorney's office here for the Northern District of Illinois, is now the author of the book In Hand, Illinois and the War of 1812. But now we're into 1814, 1815, and onward and upward. And it is upward in terms of population growth, in terms of settlement, in terms of agriculture, I suppose, and also in terms of trade and early industry?
Oh, definitely. At the time of the War of 1812, there was virtually no industry in the state. There was salt manufacture down in southeastern Illinois, but there was really no surplus that would have supported tradesmen or professionals or, for that matter, manufacturers. It was all a matter of subsistence agriculture.
But by 1820, the boom is really on.
By 1820, the boom is on, and one of the key events was the sale of the public lands. At the time of the War of 1812, there were no more than 200 to 300 freeholders, people who actually owned the property they lived on in the territory of Illinois. The war made possible the surveying of land in southern Illinois and then advancing into central and ultimately northern Illinois. But once it was possible to acquire good title to land, people, of course, moved in.
And what's happening to Chicago, particularly in those post-war years?
In the 1820s, very little. It was the growth was initially quite small because, again, it was very remote and around a small rebuilt Fort Dearborn. By the 1830s, however, it was clearly on its way, and it was stood on the what had once been the portage and then later became the commercial highway between the Illinois River and its system, its connections with the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes. Up until the middle of the 1830s, though, Indians were still seen around the city, or the village, I guess, still at that point, until they were finally removed in about 1835-6.
It's interesting to remember that you go forward some 30 more years to the nomination of Abraham Lincoln to run for the presidency of the United States. That convention is held in a temporary structure built also, I think, on the banks or near the banks of the river, and it's called the Wigwam.
Another reminiscence, perhaps, of the old Indian days. Of course, Chicago itself is an Indian name.
Does it really mean place of the smelly onion? Or
I've been told that, but I couldn't confirm it. I don't speak Potawatomi.
Nor do I. A number of figures emerge in the war who then play some significant role in the further settlement and development of Illinois.
At least three future U.S. presidents played a role, either larger or smaller, in the War of 1812 as it was waged in Illinois. William Henry Harrison, who was president for 30 days, something that will forever make him beloved of those who love lists, and was in overall military command, though he really regarded Illinois as a backwater and made no actual provisions for its defense, leaving those to the local inhabitants. Andrew Jackson, at the very end, had Illinois transferred into his territory in hopes of discouraging any further resistance by the Indians. And someone who was much more involved in the War of 1812 in Illinois was then-Captain Zachary Taylor, who played a fairly active role, first in his defense of Fort Harrison, where Terre Haute is now, which first brought him to notice, and then, of course, in his commanding at the Battle of Credit Island in what's now the Quad Cities.
But some of the Indian leaders, some of the tribal leaders, retain significance in the years following the war itself, don't they?
Well, the most notable example would be Black Hawk, who was a war leader rather than a civil chief of the Sauk. And Black Hawk was perhaps one of the most inveterate opponents of the United States. And he had legitimate grievances. In 1804 or 1805, I guess it was, five Sauk Indians, without any particular authority to do it, had entered into a treaty in St. Louis with William Henry Harrison, which purported to cede almost all of northern Illinois, part of Wisconsin, northeastern Missouri, including lands that the Sauk had no claim to whatsoever. They came back with fine hats and fine coats, but they had no authority to enter into this, and they'd been sent to New York, to St. Louis, actually, for quite a different purpose. But the United States, again, perhaps not its finest hour, it was determined to enforce that so-called treaty. Black Hawk was the opponent to that. And his continued resistance to it ultimately led to the Black Hawk War of 1832.
In which Lincoln, of course, played a role, commanded a company for a while.
And went in as a captain and came out as a private.
Is that so?
Still managed to be elected president, though.
Yeah. Nor did he fire a shot, I think that was clear.
I did say that he had once bent a musket very badly, I understand.
But Black Hawk persisted. Well, was he killed in the Black Hawk War? The Black Hawk War goes into what, the
1832, and that was really the last Indian hostilities in what's now Illinois and Wisconsin. Black Hawk was head of a what might be described as a subgroup or a schismatic band of the Sauk Indians, who are known as the British Band, because he had kept up, after the War of 1812, he had kept up his relations with the British. In fact, even during the 20 years of peace in between the two wars, he would go to Ontario up to was Malden, which is the British stronghold opposite Detroit, and receive gifts there every year. And the British were doing what they could to maintain his loyalty. Of course, when the time came in 1832, when he was in need, when he crossed back to try to reclaim the Sauk lands in northwestern Illinois, they didn't lift a finger to help him.
And that's what started the so-called Black Hawk War, is it?
That is indeed what happened. He was the Sauk were migrants. They would in summer in Illinois, and then in the winter they would go on what was called their winter hunt.
The Black Hawk War was really a punitive expedition, wasn't it, against him?
Well, it developed into that. It began with the Sauk Indians, contrary to orders from their Indian agent, crossing the river in the spring, as they did every year, to try to plant their crops and live in what's now the city of Rock Island, and then called Saukanuck. They were encountered by a band of really ragtag, roughneck militiamen. And the story is that Black Hawk intended to surrender. He saw that this was... this was not going to work, but he was fired on. Some of his emissaries were fired on by the militia. A battle followed, the Battle of Stillman's Run, out by Byron, Illinois, where the militiamen ran away. And at that point, it was war almost to extermination of Black Hawk's band. But Black Hawk himself did survive. He was taken prisoner after the Battle of Bad Axe and wrote his autobiography, a very interesting book, and also was taken on a tour of the eastern cities as a prisoner of war, where large crowds cheered him and met with a lot of acclaim. And his portrait, a memorable portrait of him painted by John Wesley Jarvis, a painter of that era.
Gee, that sounds a little bit like the later fate of Sitting Bull. That's 50 years forward.
It is, so Black Hawk didn't have to appear in a Wild West show.
Yeah, whereas Sitting Bull did, sponsored by or organized by Buffalo Bill, as I remember it.
Yes,
but how did he end his life?
Well, Black Hawk, after his semi-triumphant tour of the East, was sent back to Iowa, which was the reservation land that had been set aside for the Sauk, at least temporarily. And he was put in the custody of his old enemy, or at least rival, Keokuk, who was the head of the Peace Party, and for whom Keokuk, Iowa, was named. He lived there in obscurity for 4 or 5 years, humiliated by being, again, now under Keokuk. And he died about 1837, if I'm not mistaken. His body was afterwards, unfortunately, dug up and looted and appeared in a traveling show and was eventually acquired by a museum in Burlington, Iowa, which burned down, finally giving him some peace at last.
The real story of the white encroachment upon and the white move westward features tremendous barbarity, one might call it, or at least total insensitivity on the part of many of the whites in their relations with the Indians.
Callousness is certainly a word I would use. Indeed it was. Many of the early settlers in Illinois, at least at this period, came from Kentucky and Tennessee. And for them, the Indians were the hereditary Indian enemy. These were like the Scottish clans fighting or the Hatfields and the McCoys, which is also from that area. And there was a certain lack of understanding, a great lack of understanding of the position of the Indians. On the other hand, the Indians were a failing economy, and there's no way that they could have survived. Did they have to be treated as brutally and callously as they were? I would say certainly not. But could they have survived as a sort of primitive hunter-gatherer society in Illinois while Boeing 747s flew back and forth between New York and Los Angeles? It just to state the fact is to indicate that it couldn't have happened.
We're about to, to pause. Speaking of trade flourishing in Chicago, we're going to do some commercials, which we do every night at this very moment. But before that, it's time to invite telephone calls. The lines are open at this instant, 312-591-7200. You can raise questions about the War of 1812. You can raise questions about the further settlement of Illinois beyond that war. And for that matter, some of the great figures in that war. We've mentioned most of them, or we mentioned many of them, but not many of the others. It's worth remembering that our national anthem, of course, is a product of the War of 1812, not done in Illinois, but in Baltimore, as I remember it.
That's true. One of two famous pieces of music to come out of the War of 1812.
What's the other?
Oh, the other being Johnny Horton's 1959 hit, The Battle of New Orleans.
Well, that was written later, surely.
Oh, written much later, but it's about an event in the War of 1812.
It's a great sort of country tune. Yeah. Very martial indeed. 312-591-7200. On to your contributions. If you get in there quickly, first these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight is Gillum Ferguson, who is the author of the book Illinois and the War of 1812. We'll go to the phones in just an instant, but here is a comment about this book by a former guest on this program, Rodney Davis, who was the co-editor of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And he says, for more than a century, there has been no book-length historical study of the War of 1812 in Illinois, but Gillum Ferguson has labored mightily to remedy that historiographical shortcoming. Massively researched and well-written, Illinois and the War of 1812 is a pioneering work that will undeniably appeal to scholars, local historians, and interested readers. And I can testify as one interested reader that that is very much the case. Now we go to the phones, and we'll stay with them, of course, for the rest of the available time. First up is Griffin. Good evening, sir.
Yes, gentlemen. Thank you for this program tonight. I'd like to know your guest's comments of if he thinks any similarities between the War of 1812 and 1898. They both seem to follow like 30 years after civil war, Revolutionary War, and I think that both wars are very similar to building up the American pride, where they think they can rule pretty much.
When you speak of 1898, you mean then the Spanish-American War?
Yes, yes. I think that both wars I always find very similar to how they started and, you know, the low casualty rate you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point. Let's get some response from Gillum Ferguson.
I think there are a couple of similarities. Both of them involved an effort by the United States to assert its presence and its importance on the world stage, much more defensively in the case of the War of 1812, where it was really being abused and manhandled by European powers at that time, perhaps less so in terms of 1898, but of course the United States had grievances. In both of them, the purposes of the war also gave rein to what I could call the acquisitive instincts of the Americans, and in 1898, the United States ended up with possession of Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and other territories that had formerly been Spanish. In 1812, the United States failed in its efforts to conquer Canada, but certainly not for lack of trying.
Our thanks to the caller. We'll go quickly to another. On 312-591-7200, and Tom is on the air. Good evening, sir.
Yeah, good evening, fellas. How you doing? Hey, listen, I live out in the south suburbs, and I just want to know something, if it's fact or fable, that about the Illini Indians. Somewhere around 13500 South, 135th Street South, and I-57, there's an electrical generating station, pretty good-sized one. Some old-timers out there years ago told me that this is where the Illini tribe met the end of them, basically wiped out by some other Indians that chased them down the Little Calumet River to that point, and a battle ensued. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I've never heard that story. I know there are at least a couple of other places that claim to be the site of the overthrow, the final overthrow of the Illini. One, of course, being Starved Rock at Starved Rock State Park. Another being just outside West Frankfort in southern Illinois. I think that the presence of the Illini in that area's southeast suburbs was very, 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 very small within historic memory. If there were Indians down there that were involved in battles, more likely to have been the Potawatomi or the Kickapoo.
Well, now, who were the Illini, and how did they happen to provide the name for the state?
Well, the Illini were the, as far as historic memory would go, the original possessors of Illinois. They were an Algonquian tribe related to the Miami in Indiana. And they were, at the time the French first made contact with the Indians, they were in possession of lands that went perhaps as far north as the Wisconsin River, all the way down to the Ohio River, and west into Missouri and Iowa. However, there were probably no more than, perhaps 20,000 of them at the time. And they, by the 1680s, began a catastrophic fall in their population, partly as a result of assaults from other Indians, especially the Iroquois in New York and the Sioux in the Northwest, but also through contact with diseases to which they had no immunity. And they were forced steadily southward. And the Indians, again, who were in possession of northern Illinois at the time of the War of 1812, were among the Indians who forced them out. By the time we get to 1812, there were perhaps 100 to 200 Illinois Indians in southern Illinois and perhaps another 100 in New Missouri.
So how did this area get to be designated the Illinois Territory?
Well, the first European settlers who came here were, of course, French, Marquette and Joliet, LaSalle, and to them this was the country of the Illinois. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the French had a very close relationship with the Illinois, who were primarily who were allies of the French throughout their time.
Yeah. And it's worth noting, of course, that the name Illinois has a French ending, Illinois.
Indeed it does.
Which specifies a place.
Indeed it does. Now, whether the Illini would have recognized that themselves is open to question, probably depending on whether or not they learned French.
Well, some of them surely must have by the time they finished. We go on to back to the phones. Next up is Josh. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Ferguson. I just wanted to ask you about the burning of the French settlement at Peoria by the Americans in the War of 1812 and see if you had anything to say about that.
Well, I have quite a bit to say about that in my book. And that was an outrage. It was partly the result of miscommunication, but it was also partly a result of an overreaction by a militia captain who'd been left in the lurch with a small company when the army he was supposed to meet had marched back downriver without making any provision for him. The French lived on terms of real intimacy with the Indians, partly brought about by intermarriage. So they were, the settlers from southern Illinois, the militia from southern Illinois, regarded the French as really indistinguishable, almost indistinguishable from the Indians. And so it took very little provocation to spark that crime, really, the burning of much of Peoria and the destruction of the old French village of Peoria in 1812.
Thank you, sir.
We thank you, sir, for the call. And we'll work in one or two more quick ones. There's now some room available on the board. If you've been trying to reach us, make another very quick try at 312-591-7200. Brian is next up. Good evening.
Yes. I find the Indian thing very interesting, especially the Black Hawk topic. And I took a trip western Wisconsin, and there were numerous historical markers indicating that the Blackhawks were forced out of the state of Wisconsin and into the Mississippi River near Blackhawk Park near Genoa. Is that the same Blackhawks that you're talking about, Chief Blackhawk?
That is indeed. That Blackhawk was one of the primary antagonists of the United States in the War of 1812, at least among the Indians, obviously. And he signed the Treaty of Peace in 1816 with the United States, but he, in his heart, continued to resent the fact that his lands had been, in his view, and I think with a lot of support, stolen by a fraudulent treaty from his people. In 1832, he did make an effort to reclaim them, and it, of course, ended in tragedy.
Sir, we thank you for the call. We're almost out of time. Here's a quick email from a listener up in Milwaukee who asks, will the author's book be available as an audiobook?
I'm hoping, but right now that's caught up in negotiations, as I understand, between the University of Illinois Press and the state. And this is something that will be affect just the decision on this will go beyond just my book. Right now, no, sadly not hardcover only, but I think you'll enjoy it if you get it.
I would bet that with this book, you've opened a whole new phase in your working career, and you've got another book in view.
Well, I do have another book in view, but it's often a very different direction. But a historical book, in fact, and it's a project I've been working on for some years, put aside while I wrote this in time for the bicentennial, but involves a biography of a late Roman emperor, the 5th century in late antiquity, who made an effort to reform Rome, an unsuccessful one before it finally fell. And I thought the contrast between a growing, optimistic, expanding society as Illinois was in 1812.
Is that Julian the Apostate?
No, we're talking almost 100 years later. It's Majorian is the name of the emperor, and he's an interesting fellow.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
We have come to the end of the available time. I thank you most sincerely for joining us. Our guest has been Gillam Ferguson, and the book, once again, is titled quite simply, Illinois in the War of 1812. We'll be back again on Sunday night, as usual, a full two-hour program. It will be a look at some of the best from the Extension 720 archives. Thus featured will be excerpts from a conversation with Henry Kissinger, another with Oliver Sacks, with Anthony Bourdain, with Carl Sagan, and with various interesting historians, including who did a wonderful history of Byzantium at its height. Right now, we are closing down for the evening with thanks again to Gillam Ferguson for joining us. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night to all.